Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle. Thank you for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com, as well as the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. You can click subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, basically any podcatcher that you listen through, or if you just listen through the YouTube channel. It's always appreciated, and I hope you enjoy the episode we have for you today. You can also find me at patreon.com/sonic cinema. There you can find early access reviews to some new movies, older new watch reviews, discussions on film festivals, short film blocks, Oscar nominees, Leaving the Collection, Life Soundtrack, those series. That's all at patreon.com/sonic cinema. So one of the things that I appreciate about having a fairly open-ended subject as far as the podcast. I mean, we talk about film, we talk about a lot of different things, and I like that rather than keeping a focus on particular types of films, that allows me with guests to take some different perspectives on films and to look at different films that and genres that we don't really look at a whole heck of a lot on the podcast. And one example of that is anime. We've talked about Miyazaki before with Princess Mononoke during my Class of 99 series. We've talked about Satoshi Kon in the past. Now we are going to talk about a long-running anime character and manga character, Lupin the Third. And joining me on the podcast is a fellow podcaster whom I had the pleasure of talking about the Coen Brothers' Miller's Crossing with earlier this year on his podcast, Conversations with Robbie Sherman. Please welcome to the program, Robbie Sherman. Robbie, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on your show, Brian.
So one of the things that I like to do, since you are a first-time guest, is to kind of give the audience an idea of who you are, what inspired you to want to talk about films, what inspired you to fall in love with films, and if you could do that for a little bit before we get into our subject.
Sure, no problem. Podcaster, you go to Conversations with Robbie Sherman, we go into some niche stuff that I'm into. I really like a lot of different types of film. I think my earliest appreciation of any type of film or, you know, media comes from like a love of cartoons as a child and being fascinated by that, trying to do my own animation over the years on top of other types of filmmaking gigs I've attempted. I feel like I have a deep enough love for film and TV and different types of media that I can, you know, talk about it comprehensively with people. So my whole podcast is about just doing anything that I think will make a interesting conversation with somebody. And most of that boils down to movies and cartoons that I'm interested in.
Yeah. And I know in the episodes I've had a chance to listen to, in addition to our discussion on Miller's Crossing, I do love that you talk about things. You talk about cart animation, animated films that, and other films that are kind of off the beaten path. And I know you've talked about DC, different DC films projects, and those animated projects. You've also, I know at times you've talked about Community as well, and I do think that, you know, you mentioned that you've done work in filmmaking and animation. And I think that is fantastic. And I do think that it does allow us a chance to really appreciate the art on a deeper level, to where even if we don't necessarily know everything to do with a particular style of art form, I think it gives us, at least gives us a perspective of appreciating where filmmakers are coming from when they make their films, and the difficulty of making films. I think that's an important thing that some people, when they're talking about podcasts and YouTube channels, I think gets lost. And, you know, some people just talk for the sake of talking, whether they know what they're talking about or not.
Yeah, sometimes when I talk to people about art, they just brush it off like they can't see anything of value in it. And I really don't want to be that type of critic, that type of entertainer, you know.
Yeah.
I just think that's bad criticism all around. Like, you know, I had a friend of mine who wasn't into Lupin the Third, but he could never really give me any type of decent criticism about how its animation functions or like what he didn't like about it. He just brushed it off.
Right.
It's not good.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, art is subjective. Art is something that it's going to hit each of us differently, but it does. I think it is hard to accept, especially as critics, as podcasters, it's hard to accept that there's not more to it than just, oh, I didn't like it. You know, I mean, I completely understand if somebody says, oh, that didn't work for me. I just couldn't get into the story. Well, what about the story couldn't you get into? Or what about the filmmaking couldn't you get into? And I mean, you know, one of the things I like to do here, whether we're talking about film or films that I like or don't like, is going deeper into why we have the reactions we do to film. And I do think it's important to talk about it in a way where we're not just skimming the surface of, oh yeah, this is just not a good film, or this is a great film. What makes it great? What makes it interesting? And, you know, I will say, I mean, one of the reasons that, you know, you brought the subject of today's podcast to me, and, you know, I love that because of the fact that it gave me an opportunity to see films that, as much as, while I do enjoy anime, I do have a lot of anime that I've enjoyed, I'm not somebody who is a voracious watcher of it the way that a lot of people are. And so being able to watch these movies and to see how they fit in and how they tie into other films that I've seen is really beneficial to me.
Yeah, I'm glad you had a good time with these. I think these are a little more mature than some other type of anime out there. I think that doesn't leave them unproblematic, but it does at least give us an interesting conversation about it. And I didn't realize how intense these were when I picked these out for this little Summer of Lupin thing. So I apologize if anyone just feels frustrated by me recommending these things, though I still think they're all excellently produced pieces of media that at least have a good 70 to 80% of somewhat entertaining content in them.
Right. No, I mean, look, last summer, a friend of mine and I, we talked about Emmanuel.
Oh, God.
The Blue Lagoon, and yeah, so we are certainly no strangers to problematic material on Sonic Cinema. So, I mean, compared to some of that stuff, some of what we see in Lupin is fairly tame. So, no, I was a bit startled by it, certainly. And we'll get into it, obviously, as we get into the respective movies that we're talking about today. But before we continue to the subject at hand, where can people find you online?
I'm mainly on Twitter, mostly because it's been easy to use for me. I have a Discord as well. You can find that pretty easily. You can get a hold of me if you want to find it without having to go through too much of a fuss. Please check out the show. We have about 30, a little bit more than 30 episodes now. I have a hard time keeping track between other things.
So we've already teased this as the subject of the episode, but we are talking about a couple of movies based on the character of Lupin the Third, who is a criminal, basically. And it seems like every story that I've seen of his, it basically is him getting into jams on a particular heist or crime and working his way through it. And I know my first experience with the character was with the 1979 film Castle of Cagliostro.
Cagliostro, I think it is.
Cagliostro, yeah. Yeah, I think you're right about that. Directed by Hayao Miyazaki. And Miyazaki was obviously the reason I wanted to watch it, because I wanted to see more of his films. But before we get into the particular films, Robbie, what was it about Lupin the Third that, when did you first get introduced to the character and these shows and these movies? And what was it that inspired you to want to bring it to the Song Cinema podcast?
Well, like a lot of young gentlemen, I was bred into the anime void through Adult Swim and other late night programs like that. And they had a lot of part two episodes on for a while, and they localized it a bit in a like funny, like weird way that had a ton of like odd pop culture references in it. It's a wild thing, that dub. But I would watch it occasionally on Adult Swim, but I didn't know how it functioned. And I didn't know how the characters were supposed to function with each other. So for a while, it was just kind of this abstract thing in my head. And then I think sometime around 2018, 2019, I started looking more into it and kind of realized over a while that it's just a big conglomeration of genre tropes that were put together to create unique adventures for each time. There's there's like a little square of characters that every story is based around. Lupin, Investigator Zenigata, Jigen, his Clint Eastwood style hitman, and Goemon, the bodyguard slash samurai who has a unbreakable blade in Zentetsuken. And I really like the I love adventure tropes and genre tropes, and in anime, the type of tropes it's dealing with in here are a little more Western on a certain level. You know, there's some James Bond in there. There's also just a lot of like broad culturalism to it, because it was a series that was also marketed to Italy, and that's probably its like second home as far as popularity goes, from what I've read, from what I see online. It's, you know, I think it can be a really fun, interesting, like beautiful view of adventure stories. And there's a few things about it that are like weird and incongruous too. And if you have an open mind, you know, if you're into genre entertainment, maybe that does something for you as well. I think it's interesting the appeal this character has, because they've kept it going up into the modern day. And you know, this is definitely a character that came out of Bond as an influence. So for it to still have this like massive following and interest in it, I think says a lot about it and the appeal of its character designs and sense of adventure. There's lots of different Lupin too, and that's a study in contrast and the different views that creators can have and they can influence upon Lupin as a character.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's fascinating because of the fact that, I mean, I guess the character is about 50 years old this year or something like that.
It's a little more than 50. Yeah, he's like 56.
But yeah, he definitely, I mean, the Bond comparison is very apt. I do think there's a lot of that. I do think there's a whole, I do think it goes back to the, like, some of the cat burglar tropes. I mean, you mentioned Italy. It's like, you know, to a certain extent, there are parts of some of these stories that kind of remind me of To Catch a Thief, the Hitchcock film. But it also kind of reminds me of the Ocean movies as well, where it's like this big elaborate heist.
Yeah.
But one of the things I found most interesting about the films that we watch for the sake of this podcast is that the heist part almost becomes incidental because of the fact that we're really once the initial heist happens in the first half of the movie and then the second half turns into something completely different. I think that's one of the more interesting aspects of these stories.
Yeah, Lupin has a lot of flex in the story department depending on which creator is in charge of him. I think the person in charge of these two specials we're talking about, Takeshi Koike, he's a very flexible animator, director, writer. Admittedly, he's got some touches that I don't care for, and we'll elaborate on those later on. But
yeah.
But at the same time, like, I can't deny the gifts he has as a writer, as a director, the way he's able to kind of place characters together with subtle reasons. Like, yeah, I think on the whole, these are pretty well done, despite whatever little criticisms I might have of them.
Oh yeah, I definitely agree with that. I was a big fan of both of these, and we'll go ahead and start with the first one with it, which is Jigon's gravestone. And yeah. The first thing that struck me about these, watching these, both of these run about 50, 55 minutes, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
It had been a while since I had watched an anime special that was structured this way, where it's essentially two episodes back to back. And the way that they structure these is you go through the end credits at the end of the first episode before you even get to the second act.
And yeah.
I had seen ones that did this before, and I thought it was odd, but I didn't even think about that as a possibility for these. But I mean, I would imagine these are going into some of the TV series on Lupin the Third that were going on around the same time.
From what I understand, this is the three movies, the two we have here, and The Woman Called Fujiko Mine. No, that's the series, forgive me. Fujiko's Lie is the name of that special that I covered earlier. And yeah, they're all supposed to be like little spin-offs from the TV series The Woman Called Fujiko Mine, which itself is kind of a special because it's only like 12 episodes.
Right.
And that's a really excellent TV series. There's a couple of things I'd change about it, but that's not, it's real. It doesn't have the problems these have because these other two are all male writers. So I always feel like there's a bias in these two that doesn't necessarily pop up in the same way that series has.
No, I mean, that is a good point. And so this one, this one we start with a heist where Lupin is trying to get a gem known as the Little Comet. And we get the idea that they're that this world is in the middle of an international incident where war could essentially break out at a moment. And the heist goes wrong, and basically what happens is Lupin and Jigon they start to be hunted by an assassin, basically, who is trying to kill them. And that basically leads into the second half of the story, which essentially becomes this mano-mano with Lupin and Jigon trying to outsmart the assassin. And then we've got a female character, Fujiko, who is in her part of this film. Seems like she's kind of in a trap, except for Lupin. But she's also working as... It's such a weird thing to try to explain. And I'm sure we'll get into it because it's really freaking weird.
Yeah. It doesn't have good, like, setup in that department. Like, they barely explain what Fujiko is doing around. I mean, we get it later. We get the actual reason later.
Yeah.
But the whole time leading up into what is kind of her big spot in the middle of the movie is just really odd, like, and stilted. Like, yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And, I'm curious, as an animator, as somebody who enjoys animation, as somebody who watches a lot of different styles of animation, what is one of the most important things for you in terms of what something that an animated feature or series can do that really makes you pay attention to it?
Well, distinct character animation is something I value. Like, to be able to have characters that their expressions are vivid and there's a little bit of squash and stretch, maybe, you know, sometimes you don't even need a whole lot. When we're applying it to, like, this film and these two specials, I really love all the facial expressions in it. I love the way, like, heads kind of move around and bodies move around. It's so dynamic and incredible.
I agree with you about the character animation. I love how exaggerated the physical appearances of these movies are. That is one of the things that I definitely notice right off the bat. And I think that's something that, you know, it's weird because of the fact that I feel like it's something that is uniquely suited for anime for some reason. Because, I mean, you think about Disney, you think about Pixar and CG animation and stuff like that. It's really hard to imagine them doing something quite this exaggerated to where it's almost caricature animation. And I think that for some reason, I mean, it's obviously pulling off of manga as part of the influence, but I think it's really interesting that people who the filmmakers behind these films are just, it's almost second nature for them to exaggerate character movements and character and the way characters express them selves and the way characters look. It's really a fascinating dichotomy that you don't really see in a whole lot of other animated styles.
Yeah, these films are so entertaining to me on an animation alone that I, on an animation level alone, that I can't look away from them sometimes, you know, even if I don't think they necessarily have amazing stories or what have you, or if they are necessarily perfect in their storytelling as it goes on. I don't get like animation that moves around like this as much in the modern day. When I was younger, I felt like I had access to stuff that was a lot more detailed and a lot more intense. Now, as I was saying, I really think these films, these specials, are so purely entertaining on an animation level that I don't have any problem watching them. There's like two or three things that I think are just kind of buggy as far as like the timing and pacing of our scenes go, but that's not necessarily a put down on the animation department. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. No, I quite enjoy the animation here. I mean, not just the character animation. I think these movies really did, the specials did look lovely, and I think they give you a sense of what this world is like, and I think that's the most, especially if it's something that is nondescript or something that is just not quite reality. I think that's such an important thing for a movie to do, is to really give us a sense of, oh well, this is the world we're in, and that's fine. That's what it is. And so no, I really enjoy the animation, and I think that, you know, it's funny because of the fact that, you know, we've kind of danced around some of the quote unquote problematic parts of this movie. We talked a little bit about Fujiko's role in this movie. Part of the reason it gets really out of place at the beginning is the fact that it basically involves her being almost assaulted by this thing in a red suit.
Yeah, some kind of robot, I guess. I don't know. What the hell that thing is?
I don't know what it is. It's got to be a robot, but it's like, okay, this is when people have that. When people haven't, I feel like it's funny because when I was thinking of that moment, it reminds me of what my conception of anime was before I started watching anime. Right?
Yeah,
because mostly if you just hear about anime without actually watching any, you tend to hear about the crazier stuff that goes on in those movies.
Yeah,
and that definitely is something that is kind of in keeping with that.
Yeah, I think when I was growing up, like when I was a younger man, the people that were a couple of decades older than me, they looked at anime as either stuff like Speed Racer and Battle of the Planets, or they looked at it as like really particularly creepy OVA type stuff. There's a couple of titles that just popped in my head, but I don't want to admit to knowing them because I just think they're disgusting pieces of junk. But the anime industry has a lot of frustrating elements to it, and these films are actually a little tame in some ways compared to what most of the anime industry gets into. But at the
same time, definitely, No, they're definitely tame. I mean, even the sequences with Fujiko in this movie, I mean, nothing overly graphic happens. It's just startling to see it in the context of this story. It's not the most elegant way that they get out of it, but I mean, you know, one of the things that we see in this and the other film that we're going to be talking about is that Fujiko is basically part of this, is fundamentally part of this team. And so she's naturally going to have a part to play in the larger story.
Yeah. She's the femme fatale of the series, essentially, though that sometimes is a broad generalization with what they try to do with her.
Yeah.
But she's often positioned as Lupin's only rival as a thief as well. You know, and I think some iterations handle that with less grace than others, particularly this special. But I still would say, compared to a lot of other anime series, she gets less flack than some other women have to deal with. Because let me tell you, I've watched a lot of anime, and anime can be very, very harsh to women. And I think that's where the whole reputation comes from. There's plenty of anime out there, though, for concerning people who, you know, like a very good, clean time.
Yeah.
You know, and personally, I like some adult themes. I think there are some adult themes that kind of stretch around, and occasionally this series gets into those. It does an okay job with Lupin and Jigen's partnership, bromance of sorts. They kind of play around with it just a little bit here, but since this is one of the harder hitting ones, they're not as joyful about it.
Yeah. No, I mean, and one of the things that I liked about this one in particular is I think it does a really good job of getting into in establishing a dynamic between Lupin and Jigen. To where if I had seen no other movies or series with these characters, I feel like I understand this dynamic. And I think that is one of the, especially if you're talking about an established series, especially if you're talking about long-running series, and I think that's one of the most important things that a movie can do. No, I mean, I do feel that is one of the things I liked most about this, is that I do feel like I get a complete story and a complete understanding of who these characters are, even in this 50 minutes of time that we're talking about with this movie.
Yeah, I think it does a good job as a like a Lupin fan of, you know, mid-tier experience. I kind of do wish there was a little bit more about Jigen as a person, because I kind of think he gets a little lost with the fact that he dies for a part of the movie.
Yeah. No, I can definitely see that. I mean, I do think, though, but one of the things I do think that I like about this is that it's a very personal story, too. And
true.
It does help us understand these characters. It does help us understand where a little bit more about their lives and why and what this life brings for them and means for them. And it's really just an entertaining movie. And I like the way it winds up. I like the way that they trick the assassin. I think it's a fun one in that respect. I think there's, and I love that Lupin is very defiantly who he is. He's just a very arrogant, enjoyable character to watch. And I think that comes through, but he's also somebody who, he may be arrogant, he may be a bit of a jerk, but I still enjoy watching him for who he is.
Yeah, the voice actor for this Lupin, Keith Silverstein, I'm not for sure exactly how to pronounce that, so I'm sorry, Keith, if you had around to listen to this. He does a really incredible job, actually, as Lupin. And having to watch this a few times to talk about it, I actually feel like he's a very, very good Lupin, and he can handle both the comedy and drama well in a way that maybe the regular Lupin doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, it's like these were English language, you know, and I'm sure there's Japanese dubs around somewhere.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, it's weird because of the fact that, I mean, it's funny because of the fact that I sometimes go both ways. I sometimes have mixed feelings as to, in anime, whether I'm watching a movie in the original Japanese or if I'm watching an English dub. I think if the English dub is done really well, you can watch that and feel like you've watched a more or less complete version of the film. Yeah. But there are other films where I, like Satoshi Kon's work, I can't imagine watching that dubbed. I can only imagine watching it in the original Japanese. And I think part of the difference is these movies, Kon's work is so resolutely set in Japan and that culture that you do need that original language. But with Lupin, because like you said, it's kind of set in Italy, it's kind of a European, so it's kind of bondish, it's sort of heist movies, like old school 50s, 60s heist movies. You can get away with the English language dub and you feel like you're not missing out on anything.
I hadn't even considered that too much because I always just watch the English dubs of Lupin if I can get a hold of them. There's only a few of the specials I've watched in the original Japanese because I can't get them anywhere else, unfortunately. But yeah, that probably does help me enjoy it, you know, from an American perspective a little bit more because it feels familiar on a certain level when English speaking characters are in very Western settings. Sometimes they go to America in the series, you know, and a lot of times they're in countries that have English speaking citizens, you know, that may be a second language for that country.
Right.
Did you, how did you feel about the made up country of Dororo? I think that's how you pronounce it. Oh man. I tried practicing that earlier. I was hoping it would take.
No, I mean, that's one of the things that I think is so interesting about this is that even though this is a fictional world, it still feels believable because the geopolitics involved are very believable and the fundamental story and the themes are fundamentally believable and something that could completely happen. I mean, the sequences with Fujiko being trapped aside, there's not a lot here that feels like it's going into a complete realm of fantasy. It's very grounded. And I think that's one of the things that I really like about it, about both of these, actually.
Yeah, I think they leave some of the more fantastical elements to, like, character animation bits. You know, like, sometimes the ultra-violence is pretty intense to a degree where you gotta look at those characters and think, those characters are never going to be the same again. But you kind of want to forgive it because it's just such an intricate, you know, beautiful production. The way characters move around is so entertaining. I love the way, like, you have characters that are on model, but they're also, like, not on model in a way to emphasize expression. The first little bit of Lupin and Jigen taking over this diplomat so they can get into the country, when they pull off the fake mask, there's this big rubbery quality to it that looks beautiful. Lupin has very specific facial animation that gives you every emotion. It's something to take in.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And that kind of goes back to Mission Impossible as far as influences. I mean, with the rubber masks, I mean, that's obviously something we've seen in the Tom Cruise series quite a bit. Before we wrap this one up and go to the next one, do you have anything more you want to say about Jigen's gravestone?
I think it's good. Like, I genuinely think it has good elements to it. I think the whole bit with Fujiko working at this, like, rich elite club where they torture women is just badly paced, and having Lupin come in and save her feels weirdly paced. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's definitely fan service on a level. I think maybe they're trying to use it as, like, commentary of the wealthy, but I feel it feels a little too cheap on a level for me to give it that. Like, the weird sex robot they made for this, like, it all is just kind of an excuse for her to slide around nude in this torture dungeon. It's real icky. Like, it's frustrating. Yeah. They could have had her doing any other kind of thing. I feel like they chose Edge in that one situation that it didn't need. Whereas I feel like the rest of the story with Jigen and Lupin is a good, like, little story to follow, and it gives Jigen a certain type of character, like, build, like, by the end of the film. Like, because this, the violence of his actions are different than what Fujiko goes through. Like, Fujiko is dehumanized that entire moment, and there's an argument that you could say that she's dehumanized through most of the film, and, you know, treated without respect. And we don't want to spend too much time doing it. We have a whole other special to cover, but suffice to say, it's just a real letdown. Like, it's such a letdown, like, on that level. But, like, all the Jigen stuff is very interesting, at least. It builds up not an extremely dramatic story in a certain sense, but it has real-world stakes, and it feels like people who are muted in their emotions, maybe, having to deal with the weight of these, like, giant world consequences, and, like, having to deal with adversaries that seem impossible.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really entertaining story. I'm with you on the Fujiko part. I mean, I do think I agree with you that it does seem like it's trying to comment on the rich and deal with some conspiracy theories about how the rich abuse women and abuse people in general, or not some, in some cases, not so conspiracy theories. I think there's, it just feels out of place in the whole context of everything else. But overall, I really enjoyed this one. I will say, though, I think I enjoyed the second movie that we're going to talk about, Goman's Bloodspray, a little bit more.
Yeah, I think this is where the real meat of our conversation should be. I just, man, it's such a beautiful film for what it's doing. And I think it has actually very good payoffs in ways that, like, other good genre pictures do.
I definitely agree about that. And so this film is, so this one is basically a crime story. It starts out in a, it basically starts out in a casino, and Gumman is a, he's basically a sword for hire, and he's supposed to take care of the main crime boss, and people are unsure of what his abilities are, but he shows them right quick that it's like he knows what he's doing with a blade. And we then get a heist with Lupin that puts him in the vicinity of Goemon. And we then get a massive character known as the Ghost of Bermuda.
Hawk.
And basically, it one of the things that I like about this one in particular is that I was almost expecting this to be like a Lupin versus Goemon narrative, but it's not that at all. And
no.
In a way, Lupin and everybody is essentially trying to help Goemon get redemption because his master is killed, and it basically becomes a mano-a-mano with him and Hawk, the ghost. And I agree with you. I think there are some absolutely, as much as I love the animation in the in Gravestone, I think this, the animation in this just goes above and beyond it. I think there are some striking use of colors. I think there are some fantastic set pieces in this. And it's just such a, it's such a terrific film.
Yeah, I think this also has the benefit of like, okay, the whole story basically becomes focused around Hawk and Jigen. Let me say that again. The whole story becomes focused around Goemon and Hawk in this like battle for power they're having between each other, because you know Goemon is such a precision fighter on every level. You know, for him to have somebody who keeps getting away who he can't defeat is unacceptable, and he becomes like. When the boss dies because Hawk is destroying the gambling, like a casino boat that they're on, where Lupin and Fujiko are doing their heist of all the money in the gambling casino boat, Hawk gets away, and it leads to Goemon's master, a mob boss named Makio Inaniwa. Okay, let me try that one more time. A mob boss named Makio Inaniwa. And his like little clan, he gets killed by a top of the roof falling down on him. So in a way, it's kind of not Goemon's fault, and he did try to go after the Hawks. But this leads to the rest of the Inaniwa clan becoming incredibly like finicky about him, and like labeling him with the responsibility for their father dying because he wasn't around to protect him. How the hell is Goemon going to know the whole ship's going to blow apart? He was trying to stop the guy who was blowing the ship apart. Like no one in the clan ever mentions the fact that the ship engines were being blown apart by Hawk. And Hawk is just like stabbing it with these giant cleavers he has. And that's one of the best part about Hawk, is that he has his giant cleavers that he takes around with him. And he also has a cigar, and it's a beautiful acting implement when he is stabbing the engine and creating like these massive sparks that come out of it from where he stabbed it. He lights that cigar and takes a puff on it while he's standing in the middle of the spray of the engine. It's so cool. And like, of course, you know, the only reason it works is that it's a cartoon, but it's still like striking on an animation level and beautifully staged.
Yeah, this is, I think for the most part, I would say this is the most unrealistic in terms of there's no way this would actually go down in real life like this of these two, but the emotions behind this story is what makes us believe it. And the fact that Goima is essentially trying to redeem himself and trying to prove himself worthy of his reputation is fantastic. I love it as a character arc, and I love that Lupin and everybody is almost incidental to the story, but they still kind of have a reason to be there.
Yeah, they do become something of an incidental part of the story, but basically the gang is tied into this because Hawk is after Lupin because his unspecified boss is having him go after Lupin for whatever reason. It's not really elaborated on very well, but that kind of doesn't matter to the story because the real story is about Hawk being this unstoppable machine that Goemon can't defeat. Like, this is about Goemon's failures. This is about Goemon's shame. I think it's the best of the three specials because it really does do a good job of elaborating on, like, his skill set and, like, the things that turn him into the fighter we see later on in Lupin history, if this is supposed to be early history, like I've been reading. You know, if this is supposed to be within the vicinity of the woman called Fujiko Mine, then it's very early on in the gang's adventures. And so that ties in well with them, with the gang, like, having drinks after they've gotten all this money from the exploding gambling ship. And they're sitting around having drinks. They got, like, a big pile of cash there. They're drinking Glen Keith. Like, you know, they went all out for the drinks. And the facial animation in that is just incredible. The voice acting is very superb. The drunk Lupin is hilarious. Every word he says with his voice is hilarious.
Mm-hmm. Now, and I love the action in this movie. The action in this movie is phenomenal. And especially in the second half of the film, I think there's a sense of dread. There's also a sense of purpose to the action that I think a lot of action movies have a hard time accomplishing, whether it's in live action or animation.
Yeah. I think this film gets away with so much visual storytelling that's incredibly rewarding if you are paying attention, because it instantly finds a way to show the differences in Hawk and Goemon and how they relate to people through character actions that every action movie out there should learn from. Like, this is good storytelling on basic character action levels.
Yeah, absolutely.
The scene with him going to the roadhouse, like, after he's escaped from Goemon, and he, like, steals somebody's bike is awesome. Watching him just tear down some ribs that he bought for breakfast. I mean, he bought, like, 12, like, racks of ribs or something, and just scared everybody in this restaurant while he was eating them like a monster. It's never not entertaining. And that also brings in Inspector Zenigata, who's, like, going around kind of tracing Hawk until he eventually catches him. But the only reason he catches him after Hawk kind of breaks up the Lupin gang's, like, success story they're having in their hideout while they're having drinks is because Hawk got tired and just he gave himself up willingly so he would have a bed to sleep in.
Yeah.
And then when he escapes, that shows you who Hawk is as a person. He just gets up, smashes the door down, kills the guy standing in front of it. There's this big, like, splurt of blood. The violence in this movie is gruesome, but it's also character-based. Like, it's really well done character-based. It shows you how ruthless this character is. Like, it doesn't, like he has no value in life. He has a purpose to achieve, and that goes to any means necessary. And the body count in this film is so intense. Like when I saw him like push it down and it crushed that guy, and then like all these other guys come out, like it makes me feel stupid that somebody brought him in, you know? Like Zenigata is responsible for probably 10 or 12 deaths.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this was such a fun watch. I mean, to your point, you know, when we were talking about character animation, I think this is for me, this is character exaggeration in a completely different way with Hawk and Goemon, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you look at this. Like, Hawk is not somebody who exists in real life. I mean, even the biggest wrestlers are not built the way he is. And
this guy's like 10 feet tall. When they show him against like the military, like he, for him to push down that barricaded steel police door, he would have to be able to move, I don't know, probably 1,000 or 2,000 pounds with ease.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't think there is a person in the world that represents this type of absolute tank of a man. Like, even the strongest military veteran I've ever met in my life, the biggest dude I've ever met in my life, you know, he probably couldn't accomplish what Hawk does. But
yeah,
that's fine. The exaggeration of his character within this animated world makes him compelling.
Yes. Yes. No, that's absolutely true. And I mean, you know, when we talk about the violence, there's some rough, especially in the very end, there's some violence here that is just completely unreal in how it unfolds. But at the same time, we believe it because we do believe the world as we've had presented to us in this movie. And I think it's just such a fantastic use of exaggerated animation and exaggerated performance to really get us to this place that this film leaves us in.
Do you want to move on to Goemon's training regimen that he goes through for a period of like 5 days or so?
Yeah, we can talk about that.
On paper, it seems like dull, like watching him put himself through these trials. But I think because they do such effective character animation through it all, and the whole thing is so incredibly well illustrated, it becomes compelling in ways that other films aren't able to achieve, that other genre or action films aren't able to achieve. Because let's face it, it's a cliche to have like a samurai going through a training montage, right?
Right.
Like, you know, it's something that is expected in cinema when we have a samurai-based film. It's something that we're probably going to see pop up. It's old as the hills as far as cinematic language goes. But with here, where you have the rest of the Lupin gang kind of hanging around him while he's training, they're giving little bits of commentary on how they feel about it, and that helps sort of break the monotony of it. And just the pure character animation of it alone has its compelling element to it, because there's a moment where Goemon, like, he does like some type of jump while he's standing on this big like rock pillar in the middle of the ocean, and a dolphin pops out. It's either a dolphin or a whale. But anyways, they look at each other in the eye, and you get these beautiful close-ups of these two, of this man who is gazing nature in a way that he's maybe never seen it before. It's really cool. Like, there's a lot of emotion in it. It's very beautifully done, and I love Lupin and Jigen and Fujiko kind of standing around arguing about what's happening. And it's almost like we get a little bit of commentary from the audience's perspective on a certain level, you know, maybe the less patient of us in the audience are saying, like, man, what's he doing? You know, like, I love Fujiko just saying that, like, men are stupid and walking away. Like, this has the best Fujiko portrayal in the three specials, and it's almost just by default by giving her just like little moments where she can be smarmy, or she can have like control of a situation in the way she hadn't through the other two specials. The other two specials, they do have some decent moments for Fujiko, but they're also kind of degrading and frustrating, and I think they could have been handled better. But the way she's handled here is how I want this character handled. I want her in control of her, you know, goals and destinations and what she wants to do. The sexuality of it is, it doesn't necessarily even border on explicit, but it plays with your emotions a little bit. The scene where Lupin is giving her a back rub, and you don't see that happening for a minute. There's just a shot from outside the hideout. And you just hear her, like, moaning loudly. And then you see her getting this back massage. But they still don't show you that she's getting a back massage yet. They show her face for a minute. And then you see Lupin getting the back massage. That's humor, you know? Like, that's not assault. Like, that's not icky vibes, you know? That's something that gives you, like, a fake out. Like, that has taste to it.
Right.
Oh, man, I wish the other two specials had the taste like that bit of humor did. Like, that was well done. It's the only thing that makes me think Takashi Koike can handle Fujiko Mine as a, like, actual person with agency.
Mm-hmm. No, that is a good point. And I love, there's so much about this movie that I love. There's so much about this special that I love. It's just so, it's so electric. And yet I can't keep coming back. I keep coming back to the end of this and the way it ends and the way it leaves the story between Goemon and Hawk. It's just fantastic the way that, you know, it's nominal. This isn't nominally a film about Lupin, but it's more about Goemon. And it shows that this franchise is elastic enough to where even if the main characters are not a big part of the action, it can still keep us interested. And I think other franchises could learn a really good lesson about that.
I mean, all our characters play into the ending perfectly. And I think it does, from when Hawk escapes jail up until Lupin and Jigen end up getting a ride with Zenigata because they're interested in Hawk. They've been waiting around on this mountain, like waiting on Goemon. When they are attacked by Hawk inside Inspector Zenigata's car, they lead him into the Buddhist temple where they are found by Goemon. And we don't really see how Goemon finds him, but before that, this was a really well-paced element of this. Goemon had just taken down the entire Inanawa clan, and it's such a stunning, beautiful bit of animation because these people showed him no respect on any level whatsoever. And as a character, like, payoff to watch him, like, finally realize that these people are going to kill him, it doesn't matter if he gets respect from them now that his boss is dead. He couldn't do anything about his boss dying, and he's going to have to take down all these people because they are a literal army of funeral mourners hanging around, and they're about to just completely destroy him because he hasn't taken down Hawk. That's when his divine eye kicks in that allows him to react faster than what his brain can react. And this is a silly concept, everybody. I'm not going to say it doesn't have an air of like comic book nonsense to it. But at the same time, it makes compelling animation excuses, because it gives you the excuse to visualize how Goemon is picturing the next few moments of his life and the choices he is going to make when he does that. Like, it may sound like nonsensical, but as a storytelling device, as a narrative device, it works perfectly and gives you an incredible payoff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm so glad you brought these to the podcast. It was so much fun kind of getting to know these characters and getting to see these characters and to just experience something new and unexpected. And I really love that. And Robbie, thank you very much for joining me tonight.
Hey, absolute pleasure. I couldn't be happier to do this with you. I'm so glad you had a great time. I was pretty sure you would have a great time on some level, but yeah, I'm glad we really see eye to eye on the things in the special.
Yeah. One last time before we sign out, Robbie, where can people find you and the podcast online?
I'm usually around Twitter here and there. I got Discord. You can get a hold of me through as well. If you need a hand getting a hold of me there, just let me know. I should be easy to reach. I have a new album coming out, a new EP coming out sometime within the next month with my friend from Jesus on the Moon, Jake. So that's exciting. I'll have a little teaser music video for that. I'm excited to release that.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for joining us. And everybody, take a listen to what Robbie is working on. The podcast is a lot of fun. I mean, listen to it beyond our Miller's Crossing discussion. He touches on a lot of very different things, and it's always entertaining to listen to.
You mentioned Castle of Cagliostro. I was able to cover that earlier in the year with the men who meant. I was able to cover that earlier in the year with the men who like movies as well. So if your audience enjoys these Lupin specials, I highly recommend checking out Hayao Miyazaki's directorial debut.
Yeah, and I mean it's a fun one. I definitely enjoyed it when I watched it few years ago. I do think to a certain extent, I think I like Goemon's Bloodspray a little bit more, which might be hearsay to Miyazaki fans. but at the same time, and definitely check out that episode. I haven't had a chance to listen to it myself, but I'm definitely curious. I'm definitely excited to listen to it. But yeah, Robbie, thank you very much for joining me.
Absolute pleasure, Brian. I hope you're happy with our episode. Glad you had a great time. I'm trying to maybe get one or two more Lupin things out on top of other podcast episodes going on. I got a Rough and Ready, the Hanna-Barbera cartoon property like episode coming out pretty soon with my friend Warren. So please look out for that. And I should have a Freakazoid episode I got to finish up too. Yeah. So okay, what's going on? Please check me out online.
I'd like to thank Robbie for joining me tonight. It was a lot of fun to talk to him about these two movies. That's going to be it for this episode of the Sonic Cinema Podcast. You can, once again, check me out at patreon.com/SonicCinema, wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find the Sonic Cinema Podcast. And obviously, as always, my written work is found at Patreon at www.sonic-cinema.com. And I'm going to have a couple podcasts for In Their Own League coming up as well, and I'm looking forward to sharing those. For now, this is Brian Scuttle. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thank you.